It's the 4th of April 2014, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, as it's QEDCon next week, we thought that this week we'll do a bit of a QEDCon special, looking back at some of our features on the show, which have featured people who have previously spoken at the QED convention. QED is in Manchester. I think there are a handful of tickets still available, and you can find links to find out more at QED on the Pod Delusion website. But let's get straight into it, and let's start the show this week with Robert Llewellyn. He'll be speaking at this year's QED, but we spoke to him last August at the Winchester Science Festival about his passion, electric cars. Here I am, talking to Robert Llewellyn, last August. I'm here with Robert Llewellyn, who's just giving his talk on electric cars to the Winchester Science Festival. You're one of the most vocal advocates, perhaps in the public eye, of electric vehicles. When did you have your sort of epiphany moment?
I think it wasn't I wish there was a sort of absolute... I've sort of racked my brains trying to think of a time when I went, oh, that's when I realised it. It sort of happened over a long period of time of understanding, starting to understand the kind of, it sounds highfalutin, but the energy matrix, if you like, the way that we have got used to the world we live in. It's normal to go into a petrol station, it's normal to lift the thing out of the side of the pump and stick it in your tank and pull the trigger and some stuff goes in your car and you get back in and drive it and you moan about how much it costs. And then once you start to understand, I think possibly going to a big oil refinery had a bit of a turning point. I think possibly going to one of the big coal-powered fire stations. This is when I was... coal-powered... Coal-burning power station. The hardest thing to do. A power station that burns coal. Which was for TV shows that I was making, were a fascinating insight into a world that we sort of think we know until you actually go there and you see the scale of it. And so the people who work there are used to it and they understand the kind of... the economics of it, and it's the colossal amount of stuff we import into this country to keep our lives normal as they are. Once you start to see how that breaks down and where that stuff's coming from and what we have to do to ensure its supply, then you start to kind of question it. And it made me more and more uncomfortable driving a car that I had for years, an old Land Rover that was diesel Land Rover. It was fantastic. I had it 15, 16 years. It was much loved by my family. The kids loved it because it had a rag top, so you could drive around with that, the roof on, and all that stuff, you know. And we live out in the sticks, and that was it. And they were very cross with me when I finally sold it this year. But there's something about when I started that old thing up, and this was a perfect example of how to have a vehicle that's really dirty, because it really was disgraceful, the stuff that came out of its exhaust, because it was very old. And I felt more and more uncomfortable at that because I started to understand where that fuel came from, what it had cost us to produce it, to bring it into the country, to refine it, to transport it to the petrol station where I bought it, you know, all that stuff. Mm. And then to burn it really inefficiently in a clanking old 3-ton metal box that was about as aerodynamic as a brick.
One of the most mind-blowing parts of your talk, I think, is when you talk about how you went to the refinery and then went to refine oil. It turns out they need loads of electricity anyway.
I didn't know that. I mean, I had no idea. Mm. And that was certain. So there wasn't basically one pivotal moment. There was a series of things that I very slowly started to connect together. Mm. And because there's no reason for us to know those things, you know, the normal, you know, average Joe and Joanne in the street aren't going to be thinking it's disgraceful how they only burn coal to make electricity that makes petrol. I think you have to be aware, and it's a really difficult one because I'm not a keen proponent of conspiracy theories. I don't think it's a conspiracy, but there are certainly very, very powerful corporate bodies in the world that are the richest corporations in the world, the oil companies, that don't want that information to be sort of thrown about. It's awkward. It's not that they're not doing anything illegal. It's perfectly above board. They're completely open about it. But it's difficult for their PR. So they keep it quiet. They don't shoot people that find out it. Maybe I'm a target. If a drone comes over the hill and takes me out, you'll know why. But... you know, they have such a vested interest in maintaining the status quo as it is now. Mm. Obviously, they're very critical of things like electric vehicles, not directly and publicly, but through the way they fund all the bodies that are opposed to, you know, that question climate change. you know, when every scientist on Earth is going, I think we've probably got a bit of a problem here, chaps. You know, we've had now 12,000 peer-reviewed papers that all come to the same conclusion, and then there's one paper that goes, no, it's not happening, which is funded by Exxon, you know. So you've got to keep those things in perspective, you know, but...
I guess one of the big challenges with moving to electric is the sort of chicken and egg situation of having the infrastructure to provide for it. I mean, how do you think, or what do you think will be the best way to make this transition happen? Do the government need to step in? And...
I mean, they are stepping in and they are supporting a sort of charging infrastructure. Certainly the manufacturers are. I mean, Nissan have supplied over 130, I think, rapid chargers in this country. Which is a really important step. Maintaining those, having a sort of commercial infrastructure to support that is very important. The thing that people who use electric cars now become very aware of very quickly is how the percentage of the time they charge at home. So, which is the vast amount of these, in the upper 90% of the time you charge at home, because you use the vehicle to go to the shops, to take your kids to school, to go to the hospital, to go to the library, whatever it is. Those journeys, which we all do all the time without thinking about, are well within the range of electric cars. That, you know, it's only when you go further afield, like me coming here today in one, I have to think about it, plan ahead, which charger can I use? Will I be able to charge when I'm here? Which we've managed to botch up. You know, that isn't the perfect solution. There isn't a sort of public charging, public charger in a car parking space, which there are around the country. Birmingham, Coventry, Leicester. I've parked in just regular car parks in the place where you can charge the car while I'm giving a talk. You know, that then becomes more normal. You know, you can do a bit of shopping, have a curry, which I did in Leicester. It was very nice curry. Did my talk, went back to the car, and it was full.
No, do you get that sort of anxiety? I mean, maybe I'm just mad, but when I take my phone out, because I've got an iPhone, you know, which has a horrible battery life. You know, I know as soon as I'm in the house or at work in front of my computer, I'm plugging in to get some charge on. Are you the same with your car?
No, I mean, because I am with the phone, so I get much more phone anxiety. In fact, I charged my phone in the car today off the battery of the car because I was worried it was going to run out. You know, so that's the phone runs out far more than the car. You basically plan it. You know, so you get to know the real range of the car, and you look at, you know, Google Maps are a wonderful thing. It would have been very hard to do that before. You know, so I was doing two 45-mile hops to get here with a little bit of a charge in the middle, just so that I didn't have range anxiety. So when I arrived in Winchester to do this talk, I had 28 miles range left, so I could have got really lost, which I did. Drive around Winchester for half an hour, which I did. And you know, that would be bad if you timed it so that you had 1 mile left when you got to Winchester. So you kind of learn that. You give yourself a bit of a buffer, basically, so it's not a problem. So, and also, I think the big difference is that is a thing that people don't understand, and I've only understood in the last couple of years since talking to the engineers behind these vehicles, is that the second biggest box in an electric car, so the batteries is the biggest box. The second biggest box is the battery management system. It's a very complicated piece of electronics that uses the middle of the battery's capacity. So they say the Nissan Leaf, for example, has a 24 kilowatt hour battery. It's much bigger than that. I don't know. They won't reveal how much bigger. So when it's full, it could take a load more. And when it's empty, it's nowhere near empty. And that protects the battery to an enormous degree, and it increases the life of the battery. So that side of the technology is something. So it's nothing like a phone or a laptop. The battery in that car is a completely different technology. The way it's used is completely different. And that's why, in effect, the electric car research has come out of the computer industry more than the automotive industry. You know, the Tesla comes out of absolutely Silicon Valley computer nerds who understand how things like battery management work, how computers work, how engine control systems work on a computer level. So they're really computers with wheels.
I wonder if we'll see people overclocking their cars like you can with computers to try and get the max out of the battery.
You will, and you have, and they've done it, and yes. You can imagine that it wasn't long before the first Nissan Leaf or Renault Zoe was hacked.
So I guess the big sort of competitor to electric as a future is hydrogen. Do you think we're going to... that battle, if I can sort of sensationalistically frame it like that, needs to be resolved before we have a sort of viable solution. Is it like DVD versus, or sorry, Blu-ray versus HD DVD, or can both coexist?
I mean, it would be insane for them not to coexist. They should coexist. And my only criticism about hydrogen is that it's been used for my entire life, because the first time I heard about hydrogen cars was in 1972. I'm old enough to remember that, which was during the oil crisis when the OPEC countries put up the price of oil very suddenly, and there were queues outside petrol stations, and it was all, you know, really was the end of the world at the time. It was absolutely chaotic. The price of oil went off through the roof. And at that time, there was an advert that was shown in cinemas, which was a, you know, some sort of engineer type figure in a white coat saying, "In the future, we'll all be driving hydrogen cars." 1972. In 15 years, he said, we'll be doing it. So that, and that has repeated itself endlessly. And that notion is absolutely funded by the oil industry, the concept of that, which is a shame, because the technology is perfectly valid and a brilliant idea. I mean, if you can drive a car and the only thing that comes out of the back of it is some water. What a genius thing. And it's just that the hype that surrounds it, because oil companies, we get all our hydrogen from oil at the moment, oil companies clearly see that as a bridge from their point of view to maintaining their position of being a fuel supplier. And there's, you know, and I'm not saying this as a criticism, I'm saying this as an observation. It makes absolute sense, economic sense, for them to maintain their system. So instead of a petrol pump, there's a hydrogen pump. And it fits in with their market idea that you can still make money out of that, which is fine. There's not, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. And the battery electric car and all the things that are growing out of that, there's a lot of new battery technology, completely bypasses a massively powerful corporation or a series of corporations. And they don't, you know, and understandably, they don't like it, because the history of the human race and big companies is littered with you know, hollow buildings that nothing happens in anymore, because they used to make steam trains. Well, we've moved on, you know. And I mean, I love steam trains, and that's really good that there are people maintaining them and they still exist, so kids can see steam trains. But nobody makes steam trains anymore, you know, and that technology was overtaken. And that's the fear, I think, that all the big oil companies in particular have, that they'll be an irrelevant thing. And I think the other crucially important thing to say is that oil is really important. I'm not anti-oil. I'm not anti-extracting oil, because it's incredibly useful stuff. And I think we should extract it, and we should use it possibly in a more sensible way, because we get so much from it. Pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, plastics, a huge range of products are made from oil. The one thing we should stop doing with it is burning it. That's really my...
That seems acceptable. So finally then, you end your talk talking about the Berlin car sharing scheme, which I guess works a bit like the Boris bikes in London, but with cars. Do you think that ultimately the solution to energy problems and transport problems like this is we just need to get over the idea of private car ownership and be Marxist about it?
I don't know if it, I mean, that, because what's interesting is that you could say that it's a sort of Marxist idea, but in fact it's extremely capitalist. It's a commercial idea, that, you know, it's a commercial company that runs the car sharing systems in Berlin. I mean, I picked Berlin because it's a city I've spent time in and used the cars, so it's happening all over the place. But it does. Once you start looking at the big picture, it's impossible for the world to make the number of cars that it's possible there might be people who can afford them. So with a massively expanding middle class in both India and China, with a huge new market for cars, which are at the present all petrol cars, which means that there's a huge new market for petrol and oil, which means that there's only one possible solution to all that, and that is that petrol will get more expensive for everyone because the demand is so high. You know, I'm talking in the next 10 to 15 years, that we need to think of an alternative way around that. And one of those, I think, you know, one of the answers is possibly electric cars. One of the other answers is not having a car. You know, that you shed that. And there was something about that it was very relaxing to get in a car that was a really useful thing, and I really liked it. It was raining when I was in Berlin, so I was really grateful. Get in a car, drive to where we were going, get out, and that was the end of my relationship with that car. I didn't have to worry about the MOT, the insurance, the tax, the parking, the da-da-da, all that huge list of things that I find a burden. I'm really rubbish at doing it in this country with my cars. Wouldn't it be great? And then the next step is cars that you don't have to drive. You know, the idea that it's made me want to live longer. because I want to live so that I'm in my house, go on my smartphone, press an app.
Someone go, up a car or something.
And then 10 minutes later, there's a little thing arrives outside my like that, and I get in and it takes me to Tesco's. And I've got my shopping bags and my loyalty card, drops me off outside, and it goes off and does something else. It doesn't wait there. You know, there is a way of using the technology we've got so much more sensibly so that those cars are working all the time and not sitting around doing nothing, which most cars do most of the time.
Brilliant. So on that note, we'll leave that. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you, Robert. Thank you so much. Now, one of the other big name speakers at next week's QEDCon is Nate Phelps, the son of the late Fred Phelps. Now, I was lucky enough to speak to him on the show way back in July 2010. So do bear in mind, it was a very different time. Here's me talking to Nate Phelps. You've now left the church and you're an atheist, I believe, and you've spoken at gay rights events and so on. I was wondering if you could explain your journey and how you got to this point.
Well, you know, it's fairly long journey. I mean, the whole time I was growing up there, I had questions and doubts, but wasn't really in a position to voice them or to pursue them. And then when I was, you know, left and had started living my adult life, I continued to go to church. It wasn't the same kind of church, but kept having questions, kept asking questions and reading books. Went to a couple of counselors and finally just got to the point where I realized that I didn't believe any of it anymore.
So what first sparked the changing of views? Was it a gradual process or was there one moment when you thought, hang on, I don't believe in all this stuff I've been brought up to believe?
Yeah, no, it was definitely a gradual process. When I was a child, a lot of the doubts came from hearing one thing from my father, but then seeing how he behaved and how he treated other people. And that created a lot of conflict and confusion in my mind about, you know, the idea that we were special or chosen, but we were basically just acting like, you know, so cruel towards other humans. So then when I got, when I was older, was able to actually question it and voice my concerns and pursue new information, then there was a lot of conflict I saw actually within the Bible, and finally just started questioning the authority of the Bible as the voice of God as it is presented, right?
So did you actually challenge your father over any of this, or was this all sort of inside your head, or did you ever argue with him?
Yeah, no, he didn't argue with my father. That was very dangerous. You know, there was he was so prone to violence as it was that any kind of input that he got, I mean, he saw enough dissension and enough evil in his children without us coming right out and voicing our concerns or questions about his theology.
Ah, so when it all came to it, when you decided to leave the church, did you try to tell him or did you just stop turning up or leave?
No, yeah. I had an older brother who left when I was about 15, and I watched how my father reacted to that and, the attempts that he made to force him back home. And then finally, once he realized he wasn't going to be able to, he was preaching and railing against him constantly in church. So, I knew the consequences of leaving, and I sure as heck wasn't going to communicate with him or give him any kind of sense that I was planning on doing the same thing, because it just wasn't safe.
How old were you when you left? Were you about 18, I read, I think.
Yeah, I actually left the night of my 18th birthday at the stroke of midnight, as soon as I could leave legally.
Wow. So it was sort of pre-planned then, leading up to it, you thought, I'm going to leave on my 18th birthday.
Yeah, I had to wait till 18 because my older sister left when she was 17, and he was able to force her physically back home and was very violent with her once he got her back home. So I knew I couldn't leave beforehand or, you know, I would be subject to that kind of treatment.
This might sound a bit strange. I don't know. Do you have any good memories of growing up at all? Or was it all very much this atmosphere?
Well, no, I mean, I had some good memories growing, you know, with my siblings. I have 12 brothers and sisters, and, we managed to find ways and opportunities to have fun together. But as far as memories of my father, no, I don't have good memories of him at all.
Did you discuss your dissenting views with your siblings or other family members?
Not so much with my siblings, again, because there was such potential for violence and for trouble, and one of the aspects of growing up there was that because the violence was so extreme, that if one of the kids found themselves in the line of fire just for self-preservation, they would willfully throw someone else under the bus to avoid my father's wrath themselves, right? So I had to keep that all to myself.
So was the sort of Christian, Bible-y atmosphere consistent, or did the family ever engage in any sort of normal activities? Did you ever switch off from religion, even for a few minutes, say, to watch TV, or...?
Well, that's an interesting question, because, you know, that kind of assumes certain beliefs. We watched television. My father watched television constantly. We listened to the radio. We went to public schools. It was just that when he was expressing his theology and preaching his ideas of the Bible and God, that was clearly understood to be the framework within which we were to view the world. So it wasn't like you might imagine in, you know, some of these other communities where they don't have telephone or they don't have television. We had a fairly normal exposure to the outside world, but we had that very extreme interpretation of it that we got from our father every Sunday and throughout the week.
But did he ever, like, manage to switch off when he watched TV, or did everything make him angry? I imagine he wouldn't have had to leave TV on for too long before something riled him up from the sort of picture that everything we know about him paints.
Yeah, well, I mean, what he would do is he would see the world, you know, exposed to him on television or in the newspaper or any other source of media, and then he would use that to, you know, he'd go get up on Sunday behind the pulpit, and he would meticulously dismantle, you know, whatever ideology or behavior that he saw that, you know, as a threat to our Christianity. And he would dismantle it, and he would speak against it, and he would show the right belief system to have from his interpretation in the Bible, and then he would declare them condemned to hell. So, you know, throughout my childhood growing up there, we pretty much heard eventually about everyone and every idea, and it was condemned, and ultimately realized that from his view of the world, the entire world was condemned for one sin or another and was going to hell.
So I guess the Westboro Baptist Church is best known for the God hates fags slogan. Was that... Did your dad derive that sort of homophobia from his religion, or was he a homophobe before he found religion, if that was the case, do you know? Or...
Well, of course, my observation was, you know, from what I grew up with, was that he got it all from the Bible, that he considered homosexuality as like the ultimate sin because, you know, there's passages in the Bible that talk about God giving them up. So he saw that as an indication that that was a special sin that you couldn't recover from.
Is that why there's such an intense focus on homosexuality and not any of the other, you know, sins that the Bible doesn't approve of?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think primarily that's what it is. I also think, though, that when he decided to start doing this this campaign against him, it was also a big issue in the media that... you know, gays were trying to find equality and more rights in society, so that kind of fed that whole thing also.
You mentioned earlier that no one ever questioned your father or anything, but I believe, you know, I assume this must have happened to you as you left the church, for instance, the picketing of soldiers' funerals. Yes. Do you think anyone around him would have raised concerns about that, or would they have just been as pro and for it as he was?
Well, I think that, first of all, he preached independence for his church all the time I was growing up there, so he wasn't bound by any hierarchy, you know, like the Southern Baptist Convention or any of that. He was very independent. He didn't have anybody he was accountable to above him. There was a group of elders, as he called them, within the church, but none of them were capable of challenging him successfully. You know, there was a few efforts I remember growing up there where they challenged some position that he took or some behavior of his, and they got beat down. So the reality of it was there was no challenge to his authority. He was the final authority on everything. So, you know, it just gets to the point where that's just the way it is. You don't have any ability to question. You don't have any ability to turn back some of my theology or idea that he has. So you just learn to live with it.
You've obviously left the church now and distanced yourselves from these previous views and spoken out at gay rights events and so on. What do you think would be the best tactic to combat the sort of message that the Westboro Baptist Church puts out? Because they do seem to crave publicity to an extent. Do you think we should be engaging with them, or should we just ignore them?
Well, the problem I have with this argument about ignoring them is that it's really not a practical argument, because it's not going to happen. I mean, you would pretty much have to have everybody deciding simultaneously to switch it off and not give it any more attention. Of course, if that could be done, I think that would be the right answer. But since I don't believe it can, I think the right answer is to do something positive in response to what they're doing. And you see quite a lot of that here in the States now, where groups will organize and they'll put together counter-protests where they raise funds based on how long my family's there picketing, and then they'll turn that money over to some organization that is, you know, supporting the groups that they picket against.
What do you make of the more sort of comedic protests? Like, I think there was a famous one with Michael Moore driving a van to one of the protests. And there's like clips on YouTube of people going up with stereos playing Rick Astley music and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's humorous, and I think it's effective to the extent that it distracts people from that kind of foul and evil and strident message that they've got out there. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. It doesn't really accomplish anything in and of itself, other than to make those there feel a little bit better. But there's certainly nothing wrong with it.
Given your experiences, and I believe now you're an atheist, I've seen pictures mocking religion on your website and so on. What's your sort of perspective on secularism and atheism? Do you think there's still room for moderate religion, or are you on the side of the more forthright atheists who think we should argue with religious people and try to get them to lose their beliefs?
Well, yeah, see, that's a good question, actually. I there's a part of me that says, because the world is the way it is, especially in America, and that people who want to perceive themselves as doing good see religion as the vehicle to do that. So in that sense, religion has some positive effect on society. But ultimately, my issue or my challenge about to religion is that so long as humans continue to say that it's okay to carry a belief system that is based on faith, and they are tacitly given approval to groups like my father or groups like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, you know, the extreme religious interpretations of some holy doctrine, right? And so as far as I'm concerned, all religion is culpable at some level for that.
So final question. I understand that you're writing a book about your experiences. Have you made much progress? Do you know when it will be out yet and so on?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a work in progress. I started writing about 2.5 years ago and I have the material there. It's written. It's not in completed form, but it's just tough right now to find publishers. It's an interesting climate here in America, but still working on that. You know, basically the way it is if we found a publisher, it would be finished in probably 2 or 3 months and ready to go to press.
That's really surprising, because you'd think you've got a really compelling story. That's the sort of thing that would fly off the shelves.
Yeah, and I think that I think probably something will break here shortly. It's just there hasn't been the level of publicity to the story. So I think it's just a matter of time.
So when it is published, we'll certainly cover it on the Pod Delusion, and we'll have links to buy it on the Pod Delusion website. Nate Phelps, thank you very much. Now, last year, after speaking at QED, well, okay, a few months after, Helen Chersky set sail for the Mid-Atlantic and spent something like 6 weeks trapped on a small boat studying bubbles. Whilst she was on the boat, we thought we'd like a challenge at the Pod Delusion, so we thought, can we get her on the phone? And that's exactly what we did. Here's Liz talking to Helen last October.
So, can you tell us where you are exactly? Or are you just basically out in the North Atlantic, or do you know more precisely where you are?
I'm not anywhere. There's screens around here that have coordinates on them. Oh, there might be a computer just here. I can have a look. Oh, where's the page gone? Where's the page? It's got latitude and longitude on it. Oh, I don't know where that is. Anyway, we're about 53 north and about 46 west, somewhere around there. So out just sort of south of Greenland, about a couple of 100 miles, maybe, something like that. So if you go down to the point of Greenland, you keep going south of it, we're bobbing about there.
So how did you get there? Is it a bit of a journey?
But the amazing thing about being on the ship is that you sort of have the freedom of the ocean. You know, when you're on land, you're kind of constrained, right? You have to go where the roads are. And when you're at sea, you just kind of point yourself at a bit of the ocean and go, right, we'll go there. So we left Greenland and went down a little way, and then we sort of did a bit of a zigzag around looking for different conditions in the ocean. So we've been doing a mixture of things. Sometimes we've been going in a straight line because we've got somewhere we want to go. And sometimes when we put the boy over the side, what we'll do is just bob along and float with it. And then we just, it looks like an etch-a-sketch, basically. Someone possibly who's drunk using an etch-a-sketch, they're not, they're a little wiggly line. So we bob about all over the place. And then we'll pull it back in and go somewhere else and go in a straight line. So it's been a bit of a weird journey to get here. Sort of mixture of direct transit and little bobbing around, not doing very much.
So have you found your storm? I know you were, when we interviewed a few weeks ago, the point was to get into a storm and sit there. Has there been quite big storms?
There's been a couple, and what's about to happen, actually, is probably the biggest yet. So we had a couple of big ones earlier on. Let's see, we've been out here 2 weeks, and we've probably had two proper storms and a few stormy bits and pieces. And then tomorrow, so we've just put our buoy in the ocean. We put it there this morning, and the wind's rising now. I think it's about 20 knots now. We're expecting it to get to 50 knots about 12 hours from now. And the predicted sea state is that there'll be waves that are 10 or 12 meters high. And it's all only going to last for a day, we think. So we're waiting for that to blow past. And that'll be the biggest storm yet. The reason we're out here is that it's really hard to measure in these high wind speeds. And I think what we're about to get in the next 24 hours might be the highest we'll get on the whole cruise.
Oh my God. So 12 meters. Are you just going to, like, tie yourself to a bunk and not move for the whole storm?
Well, the advantage, actually, it's actually a lot easier when you're not trying to go somewhere. The way that the easiest thing to do in a storm is actually just to point the nose of the ship to where the wind's coming from and let it all wash past you. And if you're not trying to move through it, actually, you'll just sort of ride up and down on top of it, and it's not that bad. If you're trying to go across the wind, so if we were trying to go south and the wind was coming from the east, that's really, really bumpy. But since we're not trying to move, it sounds terrifying, and it looks terrifying when, you're on the bridge of the ship and there's this wall of water in front of you, and then it just vanishes underneath you and the next one comes along. But we're just bobbing about on top of it, and it's definitely rough, but because we're not trying to go anywhere, it's not as bad as it could be.
So, what is the buoy actually measuring?
So what we're doing is trying to understand how the ocean breathes. And there's lots of scientists on the ship measuring different gases and particles coming in and going out of the ocean. And my bit is a bit different. So we think that bubbles help the ocean breathe. So as bubbles underneath breaking waves sort of taken down into the ocean, and then as they come up to the surface and pop, they're little elevators for gases and particles. And so in order to get to where the bubbles are, you can't just sit on the ship and watch, so you have to get in the water. Unfortunately, I don't have to do that personally. So I've got this big, long, yellow buoy, which is 11 metres tall. It's got it in the ocean, just on top of it is above water. And what it's got underneath the water is lots of devices for measuring bubbles. So it's got a sonar for looking at the shape of bubble plumes, and various acoustic devices and a high-speed camera to look at the bubbles themselves. And the idea is that while this enormous storm is going on, with waves breaking over the top, all of these instruments below the waterline will be actually looking at individual bubbles, looking at how big they are, how long they last, where they are, and trying to piece together some of that mystery underneath the water, because we've all seen breaking waves from the top, but actually getting at the underneath it where all the important stuff happens is quite a lot harder. So this buoy is designed to try and measure some of that.
So you had some earlier problems with your buoy, as we were following on Twitter and things like that. What went wrong, and like, how do you fix something in the middle of the ocean on a boat?
Oh, I feel like I fixed everything. The problem with this sort of work, firstly, is that it's slightly unpredictable. And secondly, like you say, you are in the middle of the ocean, you have limited resources. So I had two problems, really. We had two problems. One of them was that the second time the buoy went out, when it came back in, just as they were craning it over the side, and imagine this huge, very heavy buoy coming in horizontally. Once that starts swinging, it starts to look a bit like a wrecking ball. And so the ship rolled at just the wrong moment, and the delicate top end of it smashed against the ship. The little stood there and went, oh! And it definitely came back in more pieces than it went out, and some of the pieces didn't come back at all. And that's the sort of thing that happens, which is why we have loads and loads of spares. So we spent a few days basically reconstructing everything, some scratches in some cases. And I had a few other things to fix because I've got a lot of new experiments that have been tried out in big seas before. So they've needed a bit of tweaking. So I feel like I spent all of the time, 2 weeks with a spanner in my hand and 6 weeks of chromosome. That's, you know, it's all right as long as it gets fixed. And I think I fixed it, and now it's all gone back in the warmth, so I can not worry about it for 3 days. So the reason we're out here actually for quite a long time, we're out here for just over 5 weeks in total, is firstly because weather doesn't always arrive when we want, and secondly because everyone knows these difficult conditions, things are going to go wrong. So in order to get what you want, you plan for a bit of extra time, so you plan for this fixing time. Even though you don't know what it is beforehand, you're going to have to fix.
Was there something specific that you're predicting to find out? Like, do you have a specific hypothesis, or are you just trying to collect as much data as possible?
I have a few. There are lots of little hypotheses too. Like, so what we think is happening is that very, very high wind speed. So in the ocean's breathing all the time across the surface. And obviously, as you get bigger winds, you get bigger waves, you get more bubbles, you get more mixing. So we think, first of all, that bubbles are making a contribution to the amount the ocean freezes. No one's actually ever directly proved that. It's very, very likely, but we don't know when that matters and where it matters. And maybe it matters in cold water, but not in warm water. Maybe it matters when there are things growing in the ocean, but not otherwise. And basically, we hardly have any data at all. So the point of being out here in these horrible conditions is to try and get just some measurements at very high wind speeds, to get an idea about what's going on. And then after that, I've got theories about bubble behavior because I also do lab work. So I think that, for example, temperature makes a difference to how bubbles form. And if it does that in the lab, maybe it does it in the ocean. So it would be lovely to see those differences as well. But I think for this first go, it's just going to be the very big differences, and we might get the details later on.
From the previous time the buoy's been out, have you got some good data from that, or have you not had a chance to look at it?
I haven't had much of a chance to look at it because I have been doing a lot of fixing things, but it definitely has missed. It's been out in some good conditions. The sonar data is actually the thing I like the most. So the sonar is sitting 8 meters underwater and it's looking back up at the surface, which is really cool because you can see the sea surface, you can see waves coming along towards the buoy, and you can see waves breaking. And so you've got a sort of cross section through the ocean at that point, which is just lovely data. I really love watching that. Because, you know, those pictures, you sometimes get those put together pictures of icebergs where you can see the tip of the iceberg at the top and then there's a great big image of all the stuff underneath. It's a bit like being able to see that underneath it. So we can see from the cameras on top, we can see the breaking waves at the top. And then suddenly you have the sonar data and other acoustic data and you can see all that stuff underneath you couldn't see before. So at the moment I can see it. I haven't done any analysis because what we want to do is match it with the conditions, you know, when the wind's doing this, what are the bubbles doing? When the temperature's doing this, what are the bubbles doing? And I haven't got to that analysis yet. But I can definitely see these big plumes of bubbles coming in, which is really exciting because I study these things, right? And I don't ever get to actually see them. This is as close as it gets, really, to actually seeing them in the open ocean because they're always hidden below the surface.
Cool. Are other people doing research as well? Are there other kind of buoys or anything else that other people are doing?
So we're the only people who are putting things over the side. There's another little buoy that's going out. So there's buoys and buoys, right? So I learned my oceanography in America, so I tend to say buoy, but the British say buoy. And I know you would say buoy. So there's a little yellow thing called a wave rider, which just bobs up and down on top of the wave and has an accelerometer in it. So for measuring the acceleration, you can actually measure directly what the surface of the sea is doing and how rough it is and how choppy it is and whether they're big smooth waves or lots of mixed-up waves of different sizes. So that's the only other thing that's going over the side. Everything else is measuring on the ship, which is why we have to be in the middle of the storm. So there's a big mast on the front of the ship, an extra mast, and it sticks right up at the front where the ship can't affect the measurements. And the devices up there are taking the atmosphere, basically, and sucking it down into labs just underneath and measuring the different gases that are in it. So lots of gases that come and go across the ocean surface. So carbon dioxide is the main one, but also acetone, methane, various other organic and sulfur compounds. So we're sort of like smelling the breath of the ocean, but that doesn't sound very nice. it's something like that. So that's all at the top of the ship. And there's also something up there that's measuring particles. So, you know, when you hold a fizzy drink up to your nose and you feel little particles being spat upwards, the white horses on the ocean, these foam patches are also spitting particles upwards. So we're also measuring those particles. And that's pretty much everything. It's there's gases and particles, and then there's bubbles, and a few other little bits of pieces, but just getting that done is a huge amount of work that's keeping shipboard people happy.
So what is it like to be on the boat, aside from when you're madly fixing various bits and pieces? What do you do all day?
It's not as claustrophobic as you think. The first time I went on the ship, I was really worried that I would get cabin fever really, really quickly. And I didn't in the end, because you sort of accept your surroundings. So there's a big main lab, which is where I'm standing now. It's got tables and benches and, you know, loads of tools everywhere. Down below, there are the cabins where we sleep. And then upstairs, there are rooms, you know, there's a mess deck, so there's a dining room, cafeteria area, and a little library, and just stuff, you know, it's like a little mini village, basically, that's floating. So you get used to the motion very, very quickly. I can feel now the ship swaying underneath me. I just had to take a step backwards and stop myself falling over backwards. And it isn't, we're not even really swaying much at the moment. So you get used to the constant movement, and you always keep a hand free because you don't know when you're going to be rolled into a wall and have to push yourself off it. Everything's strapped down. It really makes you appreciate gravity when you're on land, because when you're on land, gravity always points in the same direction. You can kind of rely on the fact that if you've got a box on the table, it will still be on the table the next morning. Whereas here, that whole, you know, that sort of cartoon thing almost, where everyone's at dinner and the plates all fly sideways, that happens. So there are sort of rubber mats on the table that prevent it, but, quite frequently, if the ship rolls quickly, everything scoops off down the table. So all the tables have a sort of lip at the edge, so some of stuff falling off the edge. There's all these sort of little adaptations. You spend your life strapping things down and putting things away. I'm tidier on a ship than I am almost anywhere else, because if you're not tidy, everything ends up on the floor. Which I suppose is the same as if you weren't tidy in the first place. But it makes your untidiness more extreme. Do you get used to it? But it is just, people just get on and work.
I imagine you have like a proper ship's captain and stuff. I imagine most people would be like, let's get away from the storm. And you're like, no, let's go directly to bad storms. Do they look at you funny for wanting to do this?
Yeah, so ships normally would run away from this because it's not very much fun for people on board. But this ship operates in the North Atlantic all the time. And they're trying to go places, which is actually far worse. Like I said, if you're just bobbing about, you tend to ride over the top of it. But if you're actually trying to plow through it, that's when it gets nasty. And this ship is out here in the North Atlantic almost all year round. And they're very used to having to go places through it. So actually, they're quite used to the bumpiness. Doesn't bother them at all. They're very gung-ho about it all.
Cool. And I guess my last question is, do you think that there's any bubbles in Hawaii that need looking at in sometime in the summer, in the calm ocean?
You know, I went to Hawaii once to look for bubbles. I spent a month of my life in the Pacific Ocean on a ship looking for bubbles, and it was part of the study of optics in the ocean, and you can imagine that those bubbles make the ocean look a little bit more white, and so I was there, and we did not see a single breaking wave the whole time I was out there. So sadly for me, I've been to Hawaii and looked for bubbles, and I have discovered there are very in the bit of the ocean we were in, there are very few bubbles to be studied. I'm sure there are better bits, but I've tried that, so I can't try that one again. I'm working on the tropics. I'm definitely working on trying to find some bubbles in the tropics that are worth studying.
Jamaica, Cuba, something like that, it would be good.
Yeah.
Cool, so you have a few more weeks left in the boat. How many more storms do you think you might come across? Like, how many more times will you be able to put the buoy out?
Well, we have three more weeks. We're going to need 4 days to get back to Good Pole in Massachusetts, which is where we're going back to. So we've probably got maybe 16 more days at sea. So the thing with the storms is, it looks like there's going to be a lot of storms, but there might not be any gaps in between them. So we need some periods of calm in order to put the buoy in the warm zone and get it out again. So the next opportunity after this weekend to get it back will be on Monday or Tuesday. And we've got a very tight window. And if we don't get it out then, we're just going to have to watch it bob about through the next storm and get it back on board after that. So it depends on how big the gaps between the storms are, because it looks like they're coming pretty continuously from now on. So there's going to be lots of weather, whether we can get the buoy on board and batteries recharged and masked out again in time, I'm not sure about. But I'm hoping maybe 2 or 3 more deployments, which is good. That's what we expected. In fact, we're doing much better than we expected, so all good.
Awesome. And you said, I think on Twitter or Facebook, that you're looking to name the buoy on Twitter and taking suggestions. Is that right?
That is right. So last night I got back down to the mainland. The buoy has this kind of dome, like a sphere on top of it, basically, that sticks up above the water. And I got down here to find that the engineer who looks after it had got the electrical tape out and had made a face on it. And no one's quite sure whether it's a cat or a dog, but it sort of got ears and whiskers. And so we're taking suggestions on Twitter for a name. And if the best suggestion, we will make a collar for the boy so that next time it goes down, it has a collar with his name on it. And just to give you an idea of the standard of the entries so far, there was David Bowie, because the Americans were called boys Bowies. There was Odell Boy, Del Boy the Globetrotter, which I thought was quite clever. But the most popular name by far has been Bob.
Bob.
Of course.
Nice.
If you can do better than that, let us know. And if yours is the best one, voted for by people on the ship, we will name the buoy that and give it a collar with that name on.
Awesome. We will put links to... If you know anyone else who we can tweet at, let us know. But we'll put links out to people to tweet you suggestions. Thanks very much for calling from the North Atlantic.
It was lovely to speak to you. I should go now because it's dinner time.
Okay. Bye.
All right. See you then.
Now, way back in January 2012, Liz got a chance to speak to Adam Rutherford, the author and science communicator and now the presenter of Radio 4's Inside Science. He was preparing at the time for the British Humanist Association's Darwin Day Lecture in London, which was all about creation and issues which would later emerge in his book called Creation. So here's Liz talking to Adam in January 2012.
Adam Rutherford, as his website describes, is an author, broadcaster, scientist, and possibly most important, a geek. In the best possible way of being a geek, his enthusiasm for the stories he covers is readily apparent. I sat down with Adam and chatted about some of the themes that may appear in his Darwin Day lecture. Kicking off the interview, for those who may have not caught his Horizon documentary, he explains what exactly synthetic biology is all about.
It's a good question, and there isn't a simple answer, which is always the way in science, but it is the extension of our ability to manipulate DNA in life forms to create things that didn't really exist via nature. In the 70s and 80s, we got very good at what we refer to as genetic engineering, which is taking bits of DNA out of one species and putting them into another. And initially that was in bacteria, and then it became in animals like mice and rats. And then at the beginning of the 21st century, this sort of the next stage of genetic engineering became known as synthetic biology, which is where engineers, particularly electrical engineers, started getting involved in looking at genetic engineering. And what they did is to apply engineering rules to biology. Right, so to simply regard DNA in the form of genes and the things that control genes, but to regard them as components, as tools, and so that we could just piece them together in fully unnatural or synthetic ways in order to create circuits. And that's basically what the core of synthetic biology is. It's taking naturally occurring bits of DNA that have evolved over billions of years and piecing them together to create unnatural biological circuits as tools for our use.
So you obviously studied biology in the past. Was it already emerging then, or is this completely new, and how did you get interested in
it? It's pretty new. So I finished my PhD in 2002, which was in genetics. At that time, I hadn't come across the phrase synthetic biology, but it did exist. It's only really in the last 5 years that it's become sort of global phenomenon that it now is. It's a natural extension of genetics. And so, you know, I've been tracking this field for, the best part of 10 years now. But I think we're at a sort of cusp point where it's become a really significant technology.
In the Horizon documentary, there's frequent cuts of you looking quite amazed.
Yeah.
or just taken aback.
Yeah, I'm a lousy actor. You can ask the director. So all of those shots are absolutely genuine. One of my friends referred to it as my what the fuck face, but it's totally genuine. I know that being a biologist and being a reporter, a journalist who tracks these types of fields, a lot of people commented that, you know, why are you surprised by this? There is, well, it's two things. One is there's a big difference between writing about something in an abstract form and then seeing how it's actually done. And the second thing is that this stuff is amazing. I mean, it is truly amazing that, I mean, we start the program talking about the spider goat.
Which is now a phenomenon in itself, I think, spider goat.
Absolutely. And a number of people who refer to it as spider pig or compared to spider pig from The Simpsons, including singing the song, which I won't do now. But, you know, we've known about spider goat for a few years now. And I've written about it for, you know, several years. And then when you see one, that's very different. You know, it's very different being on a farm and seeing a goat that can produce spider silk in its milk, which is what spider goat is. So those moments where I'm thinking, Christ, this is actually really quite astonishing. They're absolutely genuine because I'm a lousy actor.
Given it's the Darwin Day lecture, what do you think Darwin would have thought of synthetic biology?
Oh, I think he would have been well into it. So one of the whole idea behind this lecture really is, there's no way of saying this without sounding incredibly pompous, but yeah, what the hell. I think what we're dealing with here, what I'm trying to talk about here, is the prequel and the sequel to evolution, right? So on the origin of life stuff, which I guess we'll talk about in a minute, it's what came before the first organism, where natural selection begins and then continues for 4 billion years. What we're doing with synthetic biology is taking what natural selection has done for 4 billion years and changing it, right? And changing it into, I'm loathe to use this phrase, but intelligent design, where we are the intelligent designers, but we are taking stuff that hasn't been intelligently designed and we are applying design principles to it. So that's the sequel to evolution. Darwin was a curious man and a bright man, and this is the natural follow-on to his great body of work, I think the greatest body of work in the history of science.
One of the interesting things when we talk about discovering the origin of life and a lot of the experiments, like Nick Lane is doing an experiment emulating kind of what's going on in the black smokers, if they create a new kind of organism, is that going to be kind of our origin of life, or is it just going to be another origin of life?
Well, we can't recreate the origin of life as of the life that has existed on Earth for the past 3.94 billion years. What we can do is model what we think might have happened and look at whether it correlates with what we know life is. Right. So Nick's experiment, he has what's known as a bioreactor, and I don't think he would be upset if I described it as slightly Heath Robinson. So it's a little jar, it's about 12 inches wide, and it sits on a bench, and it's not, you know, when you talk about the origin of life and use words like bioreactor, I immediately conjure up something which is really quite space age and spectacular. This is a jar with a couple of pipes going into it, bubbling various liquids and gases through it. So if and when Nick Lane starts to get results from that type of experiment, I think what he's looking for are the hallmarks of living systems. And Nick is a good thinker on this subject, and he's a friend and an advisor to me. This is a field which I believe has been beset by ideological thinking for a long time, and I think Nick is one of the few clear thinkers on what the origin of life is, which is essentially a process of thermodynamic disequilibrium rather than what many people have assumed it to be for a long time, which is about information transfer in the form of DNA or replication. But, you know, these are complex and wordy arguments to get into, so you might not want to do that.
Well, just to finish off, I guess, how important is this search for the original life? We can't really recreate it. Why are we searching for it, essentially?
It's the most fundamental question you can ask in biology, I think, and it's one of the great unanswered questions in biology. Mostly, I think, a lot to do with this ideological attachment. There hasn't been a great deal of experimentation in this field. Although it's very attractive, it's very sexy as a subject, it doesn't have very many direct applications, and so it's not very well funded. There are only a few groups working on this type of issue, and that's been the same for the last 100 years or so. But, you know, I think the most important type of research is curiosity-driven. If you can't address the most basic and fundamental questions that we can ask, then there's really not that much point in doing any science. It's the equivalent of CERN, right? It's a lot less grand and a lot cheaper to do as well. But, you know, CERN is recreating the conditions at the very beginning of the universe, in the first billion, billion, billionth, etc., the origin of our universe. And the equivalent in biology is trying to recreate the conditions at the beginning of life. If you're not interested in the answer to that, then you've probably come to the wrong lecture.
Adam Rutherford, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to about 4.5 years' worth of podcast archives. Also, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. That's at poddelusion.co.uk. Podillusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf and me, James O'Malley. Yeah, weirdly, it's just us this week. The Podillusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.